For today's session, we've got Dr. Michael Fitzharris. Michael has got a number of hats on. He's the Associate Director at the Monash University Accident Research Centre and the Injury Outcomes Research Unit at the Monash Injury Research Institute. Michael has conducted vehicle safety evaluation and cost-benefit analysis research for the TAC, the Commonwealth Government, General Motors, among other clients over the past 15 years. And he's a committee member of the International Spinal Cord Society, has served on a World Health Organization expert committee on road crashes, and has worked extensively in Africa, Europe and the US. Over to you, Michael.
Thanks. It's a long and convoluted introduction, but I think I wrote it. Just to capture what I do. Multiple contexts. So evaluation research is pretty much what I do from a number of different perspectives as well. I'm not an actuary, I'm a failed econometrician who then went and studied half a medical degree and then finished a PhD at a trauma centre. So it kind of all works for the work that I do in a very strange way. I'd like to just thank my team, and it's a multidisciplinary team, and you'll understand why it needs to be in the context of the 2015 evaluation. I want to put a bit of emphasis on mental health and its role, and you'll understand why we do that. So thanks for coming. There's a lot of competition, so hopefully I can make it interesting. But we have quite an expansive team in terms of skills and background, from clinical psychology, physio, psychology, dentist, and a few others whose names aren't there as well. So they're the main people involved in it. So what I want to do is just run through the TAC structure, and you've probably heard a lot about the TAC and it's 2015, so I'm not going to spend a lot of detail on that, but just to really give an overview, because then it obviously feeds into what we're evaluating and why. And that leads us to the evaluation component. And then I want to spend a bit of time talking about what the TAC do and what we did to enhance their ability to identify people with high needs in terms of return to work, pain and mental health. And I think what they plan to do and how we plan to support them in doing that. So how we evaluated what they're currently doing and in the future directions of where they can go. We think that there's some really innovative things that TAC will do, and how we then plan to evaluate that to make sure what they're doing is working as well. So I want to spend a little bit of time on that point, and then a snapshot of our findings, and then just as a why we're doing it and how it kind of works, because there's some instructive lessons coming from an academic context working within a scheme like the TAC. Just so you have everyone's on the same page, the TAC 2015, obviously no fault motor vehicle insurer in Victoria, has for a long time had as its core KPIs client experience and scheme viability. So clearly they were the two headline KPIs for a very long time. And in relation to the move towards recognising person-centred care, they shifted their emphasis towards much more an individualised and client-centred approach to the work that they do. The philosophy for that comes at a very high level, and you can overlay the UN Rights of the Disabled and the Health Department's perspective on best practice in working with individuals who've been injured from a clinical point of view, and those frameworks all the way through. But what that meant was they added client outcomes to one of the headline KPIs. So, of course, that has become a dominant driver, but, of course, you have to know how to measure it. And there's a whole lot of considerations in a scheme as complex as any third-party insurer as what does client outcomes mean, how do you measure it, and how do you stick it as one single number as your headline KPI. We have a whole piece of research just looking at that very one question. And we have many pieces around scheme viability and a little bit on client experience, but how it can be enhanced But what the 2015 did is it represented a really fundamental shift from a payer of services to a facilitator. That required much more engagement on the part of the claims staff with the individual, understanding what their needs are, a much more proactive approach, a joint approach. And there's a whole lot of structures to support that and things that are being put in place to sustain that. And the hope would be, by having a focus on client outcomes and improving client outcomes, whether it's improved return to work, optimisation of health to the extent that that's possible, given someone's injury, some of which is lifetime. So there's a need to try and obtain maximal independence for individuals, or maximal return to work, or maximal return to health. So all of a sudden those things mean different things to different people, based largely on injury type. One of the things I did in my PhD, and part of my background, I was always fascinated by what experiences people could go through, and I came from a military family. So two people could go through the same experience, and one could carry on and the other couldn't. So from my background with most of my family in the army, one of the points was, what is the distinguishing and discerning feature of people who can go through a trauma and survive well and thrive, and others that don't? So that started to bring up a whole range of questions of resilience and a whole range of other factors like that. So my PhD wasn't in peacekeepers, which was the plan, because fortunately we don't have too many in Australia, but it was looking at people who've been in road crashes. So the understanding, bringing it forward to say, well, what's client outcome mean? And how do you measure optimal outcomes is actually really critical, and what it means for the scheme. The basic philosophy is, if you look after client outcomes and maximise that at the front end and provide opportunities to do so, you will get the return here in terms of great client experience, because people will be happier, and that will be factored in into scheme viability. So there are a whole range of issues around that. You can pay for gold standard care all the time. It doesn't necessarily always mean in clinical practice that you get a better outcome, an exponentially better outcome. So the challenge for us is to try and identify, is what the TAC have done effective? Is it working? And what can be refined? And that's what our evaluation is seeking to do jointly with them. So the philosophy of this started in 2008, and it's sort of moved through to now. So it's really this bottom line is the fundamental catch-cry. Better outcomes is faster return to work, return to health, and achievement of maximal independence. So is the TAC actually achieving those things? And that's our job. So just to give you an understanding, and you may have seen this before because I stole this from Fiona Cromedy, who's the head of independence. We've got recovery as a team and then independence. So these are the minor to moderate. And when I say moderate injury, these are people who are still pretty beat up. You know, you can have multi-orthopaedic trauma. The difference with these is that they don't have a traumatic brain injury or a spinal cord. So you've got people in this group, which is a very large group, that cost a lot, but this is a very tiny group which costs just as much. So it's like 5%, 70% of liabilities or somewhere in that order. So the achievement of maximum independence is this group, and the return to work and maximising return to health is this group, and making them all happy at the same time to produce an actuarial release is ultimately what is anticipated or hoped. So obviously the processes and priorities differ within each of these patients, within these client groups. So they're quite important. So what we were tasked to do, ISCA was created by the TAC and WorkSafe to run its sort of R&D kind of research external and have an engagement with the university. So our evaluation was designed because they were having such transformational change to the TAC, its structures, its processes, and I can answer questions about pretty much all of those, was to see whether or not they were affecting their three headline KPIs and how to get there. So we have a 5-year program which runs to the start of 2016. So our job is to deliver a unified report at the very end, drawing everything that we've done together, which is pretty complicated, and you'll understand that in a second. But our core questions are really quite simple. Has it been implemented as initiated? So as the original goal was, we want to achieve this, and this is how we're going to get there. Has it been done in that way, and what's been changed, through necessity or through innovation, and what's been required? And there's been a bit of both, to cut to the chase. And then has it had a measurable impact on these lead indicators? So, and ultimately the headline KPI. So we're a fair way from answering the headline KPI question, but we do have some considerations around some of the lead indicators, and I'll give a bit of a hint as to what some of those are in the time that's available as well. And we just have a very engaged reporting structure within the TAC. It's worth pointing that out. So while I'm at a university, I spend 2 of my 5 days of a week in Geelong at the TAC. So incredibly engaged. I go to pretty much, well, I went to all the planning meetings and the weekly meetings and introduction meetings. So that's how I came to understand what was required. But also seeing how what the core questions would be for our evaluation, and that was really important to have that knowledge. But we have a really strong reporting process and an engagement from very sort of informal through to very, very formal, and reporting to the board as well of the TAC as well as to what we've been up to. But also what the board are particularly interested in what we're doing is our assessment of whether or not 2015 is working, and what elements are. So the evaluation component is pretty detailed and has 3 parts. At the start, even though we say there's 3 questions, has it been implemented as planned and has it worked? Sounds pretty easy. In an organisation that's as complex, it's actually not quite as straightforward as that because it's so multi-layered. But what we do, this is sort of our ultimate question, and we have an evaluation component. And then our status report. One of the things that I think from, and I can say this as a researcher, is that researchers are notoriously bad at disregarding the internal research of an organisation. It's absolutely fundamental, and the TSC has a really strong research culture internally. What we do is we kind of do our thing and take their thing and make sense of it and try and say, well, this is the current state of play. And that's actually really important because there is a lot of invaluable information and knowledge and corporate knowledge, because that's how things get driven internally, and we need to understand that in our evaluation. But one of our jobs is to have a status report where we bring everything together for the board to say, this is what's going on. And then we have an action research project, and there's a lot in here, and I'll go through particularly the mental health stuff with the recovery clients, the minor to moderate, because I think that's quite interesting. These are the questions. Just to recap, just to hit on the impact side of things, is there an improvement in the determinants of desired outcomes? So in terms of the KPIs, they're one thing and they happen and they get assessed, but everyone points to flags and a whole range of lead indicators. Are they even the right ones? Are they even looking in the right place? And we have some emerging views on some lead indicators are great and others have sort of a lesser relationship, one might say, to what the KPI might be or should be in the outcome. So we can suggest things in that sense as well. So this is what a little bit of our evaluation kind of looks like, and it's very detailed. But one of the things that we're always interested in, of course, is these are the outcomes, and obviously the viability, the satisfaction, the outcomes. And we've got this efficiency and effectiveness, and that's really about the service program. So we won't spend much time on this. But in terms of the new model, we went through a really convoluted and complex program to get all the original documents way back from 2007, 2008, all the board papers, to say what was the original intention, what was the underlying motivation as to why the TAC wanted to change. So that was a very significant part. And then in restructuring, they had massive organisational change and dislocation of all of the staff. All the roles were changed, people were called different things, they were classified different things. So that's all well and good for within the organisation, but the dislocation potentially for the client was huge. All of a sudden they have a new approach, they have new people to deal with. And while in the long run the idea is to say, well, you want to deal with as few people as possible, so I have my rehab coordinator, I have my claims officer, and I've got them for a long time, the internal churn of the organisation is so high, and maternity leave and people coming and going, it becomes very difficult for a scheme to maintain that. But we're talking structural change of the order where everyone was put into a new portfolio, all the clients were put into a new portfolio, pretty much, not quite overnight, but you could imagine almost like that. So the dislocation for the staff was very significant, but the dislocation for the client. The idea would be, once we do this, we're going to take a hit, but in the long run, this is what we have to do to realise our longer-term goal. And our question was, well, what impact has that had on the staff? And a very significant impact as well. So we ran a whole series of questionnaires and surveys over a period of time before the change across the entire organisation and at various time points. And we've just finished our last survey round for all of the staff in Independence, the last division, because they staggered all of the changes. It didn't just happen in one day. And it was quite interesting to see quite widespread belief but desire to shift towards the client-centred, person-centred planning. And there were two schools of thought among the claims staff. One is that they felt incredibly capable that they could deal with it, and others who said, I'm not a psychologist and I don't want to be counselling people. So all of a sudden, when we work in the context of that immediate attitude, there's a lot of capability training that needed to happen. And that was identified that they did a lot, they were satisfied with it, but there were still some pressure points where they needed to do some more. So that's the stuff that we kind of said, this is what you need to do. For an example, the early support coordinator role are the ones who work now, they are almost an adjunct of a classic claims manager and a classic case manager. So they represent this one person now, and that was quite a fundamental shift for the seriously injured clients. Those staff, I kind of call them the SAS of the TAC. They're kind of like the elite. Most of them, nearly all of them, had an allied health background. But the position description I recommended would require that, because they're dealing in the acute care context, the rehab context, and the community provider context as well. And they introduce what's called now the independence plan. It was known first as one plan, where they would have literally one plan and they would set SMART goals. So they required a very particular training. It was very hands-on. It was very face-to-face. And when everything was in play and stable, they would then pass that person off to what's known as an active support coordinator, who would be in Geelong. Now, the idea of having 15 of these type of clients in your portfolio is relatively easy, but when you've got 60 and you all of a sudden you start to manage stable and you have to go and have a face-to-face interview for all of your clients, some of whom have significant behavioural disturbance, and they do, and some have behavioural problems, particularly people with severe TBI, there are some issues, even as small, it sounds small but it's not, of OHS, of individual protection for staff who are predominantly female, going into individuals' homes, and also the issue of burnout. So even within that change, you can overlay a whole lot of other considerations in the handling of the staff as well. By and large, they love it, and they're an incredibly supportive group, the early support coordinators within Independence, because they have so much autonomy. They have the power of a claims manager, and they have the power of a case manager to really set this person up. And the idea is, in doing that, the individuals will have a really significant understanding of that client's needs. And in fact, attendance care has changed, attendant care need has changed, but things happen faster and the clients are reportedly happier. And that's the path to independence in a much more efficient, streamlined way. But it does still have its pressure points, which are, once brought to the attention, of working on being resolved. So that was one small aspect of this very significant change management. And the larger group in recovery had even, you know, different type of dislocation, because they have a different set of processes. But the assessment of the change processes, by and large, the staff really believed in it, and that became a very important thing, because they felt putting the client first for a change, we're not just paying services. was really important to them and giving them greater job satisfaction as well, actually feeling like they're making a difference. That approach did, however, have significant implications on the provider side, where the provider would all of a sudden say, hey, that's my bag. And all of a sudden they've got the TAC saying, we need you to facilitate this and set SMART goals and do this. So there's different levers that needed to be pulled within that context. And we also did this through a series of focus groups, speaking in and one-on-one interviews with staff from across the whole thing. So that was just in terms of the process. So we had document review, we've had individual staff assessments of the change management process all the way through the business. And then also what has been changed as well within the change process as it has moved forward and as the business has matured as well. And then we have this impact evaluation. This is kind of where we're at now. We have some touch points on the health outcomes, and I'll touch on that on second last slide. But this is sort of where we're at the moment, and we have a really big piece right now on common law, and I can take questions on that, who are claiming, what are the determinants of the claimants, the time to claiming or lodging, and a whole range of considerations around common law, scheme contact, health service utilisation, and so on. And then we have this outcomes side, and I'll touch on a bit of that in the summary slide. As I say, we monitor the strategy. We report to the board. I have to finish a board report for this December, so I'm furiously writing another one. Where the predominant focus is actually on common law, so it's quite interesting given the potential for legislative change in Victoria at the moment. But they basically, from our point of view, serve as a go-to document for the board to say, at least has this fundamental change, because all of this change costs money as well. So the hope is in spending a very significant sum of money and dislocating the business and retraining people and training people in new processes, new philosophy, it will be worth it in the long run. So they need to be confident that that's the case. So we also have these, what we call action projects as well. As I mentioned already, and I'll split them in three really, but this is recovery and this is independence. Because they're different clients, they have different needs, different requirements and different processes. And the claim staff are quite different too, even within. I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about this side in a second. So we'll go over here. I've already spoken about the early support coordinator role, and that was a really fundamental shift to what the TAC were doing in handling their most seriously injured. And the clients are loving it. You know, they're getting some of the best satisfaction scores ever had within the TAC, across the board actually, in both recovery and independence. So this new approach, this new very person-centred joint planning, this active planning rather than we just pay your bill and sometimes we're late and sometimes we deny and stuff like that. That's trying to shift that philosophy to a very proactive. And one of the KPIs is even number of proactive phone calls, and staff have to meet those. So those things become really important in bringing the cultural change to the business to say we are active facilitator helping people return to work, return to health and achieving maximal independence. We did do a very early lifetime care cost, a pre and post, of people in that independence group. And we can't say anything other than if what appeared to be happening happens, then it will be a very good outcome for the TAC, but very short period of time and very low numbers. So what we're saying is at the time when you would expect to pay the most, which is at the start, it's actually a lot better than what it is, and everything seems to be going really well for these individuals, for these select number. So we did a pre and post under the old model versus the new model, and what were the early costs that we could see. And there was starting to be a difference already. And we do know that a lot of that's been manifest in changes to attendant care, and the more appropriate care and the more appropriate provision of that care. And that's one of the single largest liabilities within the organisation. So a subtle change in that by understanding what the client need is, but also getting equipment in there faster and restructuring the house faster and helping the family to do those things and facilitating the family can actually make a really significant dent in that scheme viability just straight away. And that's starting to be what we're seeing. So that's actually really quite a valuable thing that if it continues, will be successful on that alone, is my view. We also had a look at best practice recommendations for individualised case management and claims management. What's the best practice and how does TAC align with it? It's actually quite good, and it's very good in relation to the early support coordinator. It's taking the best bits of both and putting them into one person. That's quite contentious because case managers say that's my bag and that's what I do. But it changed the culture of the organisation as well. And we're also evaluating the independence plans. A subtlety in what I've said is that when the early support coordinator first gets the client, they start to set some of the goals. So that the injured person, if it was me, I might say, well, I want to be an astronaut, and they'll go, Michael, you're a clown. And of course, you're never going to be an astronaut, you're a ventilated quad. Or you've got a severe brain injury. So the idea is then negotiation and negotiating, well, what can this person get towards moving towards something where they are maximally independent? I might get to go somewhere really cool. But that's the idea. So we're seeing, well, what are the goals, who's setting them, and what's the interaction with the provider, and then how does that interact again with what the individual is feeling, their family are feeling, and also in terms of how it's being reflected in the TAC as well. So I'll leave independence there. In terms of the mental health side of things, obviously, and I can spend a fair bit of time on this because it relates all the way through to how they manage clients. And we've done a lot of work in relation to that as well. One of the first ports of call that they do now is what's called the client conversation tool. And it's a standardised conversation or assessment. And the idea is to basically ask a series of structured questions where the rehab coordinator, in this case, that's what they're called, would make a judgment as to whether or not the person is high need on the basis of pain, mental health, as it's defined, and return to work. So our evaluation we did showed that, I'll show you some of the results, but we did a really significant evaluation of that to see, does it work? So does the client conversation tool actually have any association with what actually happens in terms of claims 6 months and a year down the track as well? And another one, we looked at remote mental health options, so things like e-health and where the TAC could go, and evaluating it. Our loss of earnings costs pre and post 2015, we did an evaluation adjusting for injury severity and a whole range of things, and that looks very positive. And common law liabilities as well. And we did a change management workshop where we actually got the senior management to say, when you first cooked up 2015, what did you want to achieve and what did you think were the lead indicators? And it was really interesting to get them to look back a few years and say, well, what have we changed in the journey and why, through necessity or through innovation or through opportunities that had appeared. And there was some really good stuff that came out of that. Talk a little bit about the mental health side and clients with high needs. Basically, what the TAC had discovered was that a proportion of clients, had persistent issues of problems in returning to work, and they happen to have mental health problems, and they also happen to be in pain. So these little diagrams, which have been presented here in last year's conference or the last conference, just show that, you know, the average claim costs per year for 2% of people is, you know, with all three is $151,000. These are old costs now. But people with return to work are 32% of people, and their claim costs are $20,000 on average per annum, and so on. So you can actually start to unpack what the current liability structures are and see when people actually have all three, there is a really significant problem. So from a claims management point of view, how do you deal with these people? How do you even identify who they are? Because that can change your liabilities straight away. And in just some analysis I've actually just done in the past few days, of the clients who come into the TAC, about 20% have a diagnosed mental health condition, and they range from, and my clinical staff and some of my background would say, there's people with non-dependent alcohol abuse, so the person who's abused alcohol and gone to hospital, alcohol-induced mental disorder, amnestic disorders, so dementias, anxiety disorders, alcohol and other drug dependence, bipolar and major depressive, delusional disorders, drug-induced mental disorders, and it goes on to personality disorders, schizophrenia, sleep disorders, and then our classic acute reactions to stress, like acute stress disorder, PTSD, and traumatic shock. Now, all of a sudden, that's a reflection of society, but they're in a bit bigger when they come into the TAC. So all of a sudden, those things become very important. So the question I always have is, what do you pay for? And that's always a vexed question, because these are really significant things. Now, if someone's got a personality disorder, and Sarah, our clinical psych, that's her PhD, and she works 2 days a week in maximum security women's prison, they're not the most, shall we say, adherent people to treatment. In the nicest way. They're very difficult to work with. But these are people who are coming through the front door. And some of these people with these issues are overrepresented in car crashes. When I was at our trauma centre studying at the Alfred, I would see people and I'd go, oh, from a road trauma point of view, this is a really interesting population. The random person who gets taken out, who's otherwise healthy 18-year-old male, is a little bit unusual. There's always a complication, and a lot of it is around the mental health, and then you overlay their injuries with their occupation, and all of a sudden the comp schemes have a very significant challenge across the board. And then you've got RCs or claims officers who are saying, I'm not a psychologist, I don't want to do this. So how do we even manage that situation? And that was the question that the TAC had in 2008. So what they did is they recognised this liability structure and said, OK, we need to have a tool to help our rehab coordinators, some of whom are 24-year-old males and females with maybe a business degree with no training in psychology, whereas you've got others who are actual allied health professionals who've joined. So you've got this huge diversity of skill and this huge diversity of people with really complex problems. So they developed what's called the client conversation tool, and the whole idea was to really evolve it into a situation that's an objective, relatively objective tool that can predict people who are going to have poor return to work, differential mental health problems, and poor pain outcomes. Did it work? And that was the question we were tasked with. We sort of, it kind of did, but there were enormous opportunities to improve the tool as well. The questions were singularly focused on PTSD. It was almost a lift of, it was a lift of a particular post-traumatic stress disorder tool. So the claim staff wanted and recognised that we've got people who are depressed and this tool doesn't do it. So we set about evaluating what this tool did, from the content to its acceptability to linking it to claims data. Did it work? What was the diagnostic accuracy of the client conversational tool? Did it even predict? And remarkably, the way it was put together, and it's testament to some of the skill of the internal research, is that it had very high accuracy in predicting those who didn't have a problem, but it wasn't so good at predicting those who did. Now, sometimes predicting those who don't have a problem when it's such high numbers is actually of diagnostic importance as well, because you know you don't have to do anything for those people. And all of a sudden, if that's your vast majority of people that you know you don't have to do anything for and there's a question over here, then focus your efforts here because they're going to be all right. And that's very helpful. That's as helpful as knowing who is going to have a problem sometimes. But we found that there was low acceptability of some items among some of the staff. I've done heaps of PTSD questionnaires and clinical interviews, and when you come to some of the questions like, have you felt like taking your own life, they're kind of hard to do face-to-face, but for a claims person to do that over the phone, it's impossible. So we had to try and work on some of the language because those questions weren't being asked. So all of a sudden the tool wasn't as effective. So we redesigned it, and they found a whole lot of stuff about, through the CCT I discovered the client didn't like their employer, so they didn't want to go back to work. So we were able to unpack in a systematic way what everyone did. And our idea is to say, as step care, most people will sit here, and that's normal claims handling, all the way people have massively high risk and they need strong internal TAC support, but also with very external sustained clinical care to try and help them achieve their outcomes as well. And then, so what we did, being mindful of... How much time do I have?
About another 5 minutes before morning tea.
Okay. So I'll be really quick. But basically, this is my teddy bear who's travelled all around the world with me reading my iPad. Because what we were talking about is looking at remote mental health interventions, and that's actually what we think is the future of a service offering. So things that are online, and whether it's phone calls or brochures and things like that, have some utility. So we're now in the process of actually working with HDSG, the Health Disability Service Group, to roll out a whole lot of remote mental health service offerings for people who could potentially have access to help them on their journey as well. A snapshot of findings very quickly. The staff survey showed that they strongly supported the 2015 change from passive to active. It's been very well received by most staff. The early support coordinator plan aligned with best practice. The CCT is pretty good at identifying clients high risk and those who are not. And we believe this is sort of a next innovation that eHealth demonstrates, really strong scope for a very cheap and effective kind of intervention to be offered to staff, to clients as well, for a bit of adjunct support, knowing that the people who probably need it the most won't stick to it, so there are issues of adherence for people who are most at risk, and that we're sort of seeing some move towards a very positive outcome for the TAC in terms of its higher end KPIs in terms of viability. Client SAT scores are up, and we're still to this day have a big project working out how you measure client outcomes, and that fundamentally is a really big challenge for all comp schemes, but we will do something in that space. We have this translational research program. We think it's fabulous, and being mindful of the time, I'd like to thank the people who put food on my table. Thanks.
There is some time before we go off for afternoon tea. If anyone has a question. I have one, Michael.
Yeah.
With the case managers or client managers, that new role you're talking about, and you've mentioned that there appears to be a savings in the dollars or the outcomes, when they actually come up with their decisions of plans, etc., is there any tension as far as dollars that they have? I mean, do they have a need to make sure, like budgets?
No.
At that point?
Yeah, no, actually. It's basically almost the philosophy of give the client what they need to achieve the goals. And this is the sort of the issue. The attachment of a service, sorry, the delivery of a service has to be attached to a goal. So it has to be justified in that way, not in the financial sense. And that's quite important, because if they're saying, in our plan, whatever plan, whether it's, I didn't mention the recovery action plan, but that's the RAP that's used in recovery. But if we set ourselves a certain goal, that I want to walk again, and I'm a partial spinal cord client, and I want certain types of rehab that look promising, we might say, well, that's my goal in the long run, and then we set certain little goals along the way. All the services have to be attached, in essence, to those SMART goals or those goals along the way. So if it's not justifiable in terms of the plan, then it can't happen, in a sense. So that's the only way. They're not sitting there working with a very fixed budget. It's saying, does the client actually need this to achieve this or that or that? And that's quite important, rather than saying, yeah, they're getting their savings because there's a cap. There's no cap. The cap really comes from, does the client need it to achieve optimal independence? But what they're finding is by having such intensive one-on-one, they're getting much greater acuity with the services that are not needed. Whereas before there was always, yep, just approve that. Now it's like, actually, that person doesn't quite need that, but they need this. And that can be cheaper. Whether you get them a better wheelchair faster, all of a sudden, or the OT might do an assessment and say, oh, well, they need, you know, this hand-grabbing tool to grab the jam, you know, the jam jar, all of a sudden then that helps in the attendant care space. So there's a little subtleties around timing as well and what seems to be driving that result as well. But no, there's no fixed, you can only spend this much money. And that's what's interesting about shifting from a very passive payer of services to an active facilitator in person-centred planning. It's a challenge for all comp schemes, and I alluded to that. You can just pay lots and lots of money in clinical practice, but you don't necessarily get a better mortality outcome, and it's a similar thing here. So where's the line that's drawn as well? But that's a really interesting question in and of itself. So hopefully it was interesting enough.
Okay. I think we go to afternoon tea. But thank you very much, and I'll ask you all to...